From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, thinking about the history being made this week by the Democratic Party.
Thursday night's going to be a wonderful moment in history, especially for some of us who can remember what it was like when we first wanted to work.
Plus, the pressure our lawmakers are under to raise money.
Members are asked to spend hours every day essentially calling people for money, dialing for dollars.
And new college grads trying to build startups in Detroit.
Finding their way as people, first jobs out of college, I'm really clueless in many ways, as we all are when we come out of college. And just diving in and taking risks in a way that most of their generation aren't.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Money in politics. It's one of the biggest challenges facing America's political system and our lawmakers.
The pressure to raise money is unbelievable, and I frankly wasn't prepared for it.
A former Michigan congressman is now working to change campaign finance laws. That's later in the program. But first, at last night's Democratic National Convention, union leaders took to the stand voicing support for Hillary Clinton. Union members have been a key voting demographic in Michigan for decades, historically a reliable voting bloc for Democrats. But as Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports, the Trump campaign is hoping to change that.
Hillary Clinton can pretty much write off Joe Kinder's vote. He's a retired Ford UAW worker.
As far as Clinton goes, she can't be trusted. I wouldn't vote for her.
Kinder, like other members of organized labor, believed the North American Free Trade Agreement, signed by former President Bill Clinton, was a bad deal for American workers. And like her husband, Hillary Clinton has supported trade deals. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has spent time on the campaign trail bashing NAFTA and other trade deals. He says he'll protect American workers and bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. Scott Hagerstrom is the director of Trump's state campaign in Michigan. He believes the Republican candidate can do well with Michigan's union voters in November.
All we have to do is talk about Donald Trump's position on the issues, his great plan for the economy, tax cuts for everyone, and lifting all boats. Everyone will benefit under his plans.
Donald Trump isn't right now proposing a plan, but a lot of rhetoric on these issues.
That's Nikki Bozinski. She's the Clinton campaign's point person on labor.
So I would encourage voters, and in particular union voters, where I understand manufacturing and bringing manufacturing back to this country, which candidate has a plan to actually do that? And the secretary does.
Clinton has changed some of her positions to be more union-friendly. She now opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal she previously supported, and she joined her former rival, Bernie Sanders, in calling for a repeal of the so-called Cadillac tax on some Obamacare health plans. That's something unions have pushed for. Jesse Donahue is a political scientist at Saginaw Valley State University. She believes union voters also want Clinton to change her free trade policy.
She has to, I think, reassure and take up some of Bernie Sanders' language, back away from the free trade, you know, sense that rhetoric and actually policy that says it's always going to benefit people.
Clinton has been successful lining up union endorsements, even if the union rank and file may be less solid in their support. UAW Vice President Cindy Estrada says between now and Election Day, union leaders will need to make the case for Hillary Clinton and the case against Donald Trump.
When he says that he wants to bring jobs back, he's clear that he doesn't want to bring them back at good union wages. He doesn't want to bring them back with workers having a seat at the table.
Trump's choice of a running mate also complicates his pitch to blue-collar workers. Indiana Governor Mike Pence has been at odds with organized labor on issues like free trade and the minimum wage. So both candidates will have their work cut out for them, assuring union voters that they would be a more reliable ally in the White House. I'm Steve Carmody.
Are Bernie Sanders supporters on board yet? Ready to get past their disappointment, their anger, in some cases their extreme dislike of Hillary Clinton? With us now from Philadelphia, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell of Michigan's 12th District. Thank you so much for being here.
Cynthia, it is great to be with you and everybody listening.
What do you think the high points were from last night? What were they for you?
Well, you know, I actually loved yesterday's convention because it clearly wasn't a backroom scripted convention. And I think democracy thrives when more people are engaged and involved. Clearly, there was tension on the floor at the beginning of the day. I didn't like the fact that streets were shut down, but it did remind me of my early days of being caring and emotional and passionate. Once our First Lady, Michelle Obama, gave her speech, the room was quiet. She engaged everybody. She pulled us together. And then the speeches, Elizabeth Warren's speech and then Senator Sanders' speech, they were important speeches last night. And I think we need to do is to celebrate the passion that everybody has, the intensity that they feel, and quite frankly, the people are reengaging in the process and that they do care about outcomes.
And we certainly know, as you alluded to, that contingent of furious Sanders supporters, they're visible, they're vocal, even to the point where Senator Sanders sent that message out asking them, please don't boo on the convention floor. Can you talk to the majority of the Michigan Democratic voters who did give the state to Bernie Sanders in the primary? Why wouldn't they see those leaked emails and say, I knew it, the system is rigged, and the people who run the party who are supposed to be neutral, they had their finger on the scale for Hillary Clinton all along? What do you say to those people?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say that Michigan shows you that the finger wasn't on the scale. To me, it was a decision that Senator Clinton made not to campaign as vigorously in Michigan as Senator Sanders did. And he won. And he won fair and square. So that's why I would argue that the finger wasn't on the scale, that each state had their elections, and presidential campaigns are complicated. They have a limited amount of money and time, and people have to make a decision about which states they're going to play in. He played in Michigan, and he won. But I'll go beyond that and say some of those emails were very upsetting and disappointing because I don't believe religion should ever be a tool in any election in either party. But for the most part, there were criticisms of the Clintons inside some of those emails as well. They were disappointing, but I really do not believe that this was a rigged primary system. I think that Senator Clinton earned those votes, but I have nothing but respect for how hard Senator Sanders ran, campaigned, and how well he did.
How long have you known Hillary Clinton, Congresswoman?
A long time. We are working political spouses together at a time that political spouses didn't work. So I really met her in the late 80s before President Clinton became President Clinton. As a matter of fact, he had just given a long speech at a Democratic convention, and people thought that his political career was over. She and I both have always worked for children, and I met her through the Children's Defense Fund and through a woman named Betty Bumpers, who had gotten me involved as a young wife and how I could work on issues that I cared about and wanted to make a difference on, and we both cared about kids.
So you've known her all of these decades. What are your thoughts behind that huge disconnect between the Hillary Clinton that you know and the one that some 56% of voters say they don't like and don't trust? What's behind that disconnect?
You know, I'm going to tell you that I think one of the issues is that you have to understand what it's like to be in the public eye and that you do become protective, maybe a bit defensive. I mean, I felt bad for Melania last week. I don't think anybody deliberately went out and plagiarized a speech, and that one has to think about how public and how hard that kind of speech is. So she's had a lot of shots taken at her. If you know her as a friend, there is no better friend. You know, I can give you story after story, the most recent being when John was in intensive care a couple of years ago, and people didn't think he was going to live. She was the very first person to call me. Are you okay? Do you need anything? Can I do anything? That's the Hillary Clinton that I know. But she doesn't always let anybody see that. So I wish that everybody could see that side of her. And I think she's got to let people see her. The next few months are going to be critical in having people really see who she is and having people get to know her.
And do you expect that from her on Thursday night? Is that the tone you hope she presents? Or are you looking for a tough tone, conciliatory? What are you looking for?
I want, in that speech on Thursday night, for Hillary Clinton to show people who she is, that there is this very real side of her, but she's very experienced. She's very seasoned. You know, she's one of the most experienced persons to ever run for office. When you look at her qualifications, the amount of time that she has spent in the public policy arena, the number of people she's worked with together, the people that she has brought together, this is a woman who is a bridge builder that knows how to bring people of disparate viewpoints together. She's not somebody that's been interested in the sound bite. She's somebody that wants to solve problems. And I think that's what the American people want right now, is that they want somebody who's going to solve problems. I hope that she'll show people that that's who she is, how experienced she is, and that there is this wonderful, loving, caring side of her that she's got to let people see.
Let's just talk about this moment in history and what's going to happen tonight. It certainly seems that the Democratic Party is ready to write American history, becoming the first major party to nominate a woman to be president. What are your thoughts as this big, thick glass ceiling finally cracks?
You know, I'm supporting Hillary Clinton because I think she's the most qualified person for the job, not because she is a woman. And I think because it is Hillary Clinton, and I have experienced so many things with her over the years, that is going to be a very emotional moment for me. When she and I had jobs and were married to political people, you can't remember the criticisms that we got just because we wanted to keep working. And we've got stories after stories of things that have happened to us during our careers. I am so happy that younger women don't have to experience some of the things that we experience. I mean, I am not old, but I'm seasoned. And I remember when we couldn't walk in the front door of the Detroit Athletic Club. Young women don't have to even think about the kinds of things that we had to think about. And, you know, Michelle Obama almost cried last night when she talked about her daughters never having to even think about whether a woman could be president of the United States. Thursday night's going to be a wonderful moment in history, especially for some of us who can remember what it was like when we first wanted to work. And I remember my job interview with General Motors, and I was asked in it, why would a woman want to work at General Motors? And now we have a woman CEO.
Case made. Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. It was great talking with you, Congresswoman. Thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What's the barrier keeping you between yourself and the life you truly want to lead? That's the question Cheryl Miller-Hauser explores as co-director of a new documentary film, Generation Startup. It follows some young entrepreneurs as they build startups in Detroit. They try, stumble, learn from the school of hard knocks, and then try again. You come away as a viewer with a much deeper appreciation for the struggle, the passion that goes into building your own business. And these stories reflect the way Detroit is fighting back from its historic bankruptcy. Cheryl Miller-Hauser, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
Glad to have you. I love this documentary. And as you focus on recent college grads, I wondered why, tell us why you and co-director Cynthia Wade felt it was very important to shine a light on these 20-somethings.
Sure. So my son is a fellow, or was a fellow in a program called Venture for America, and Venture for America recruits recent college graduates from around the country and places them with startups in 15 cities across the country to train as entrepreneurs and then help them launch companies. So I was watching the life-changing experience my son was having, being thrown into the deep end, employee number 11 of a startup in Providence. And I approached the founder of Venture for America, Andrew Yang, and said, I would like to follow some of your fellows, this entrepreneurial journey, and in one of the cities. And he was on board, and I then attached Cynthia as my co-director, really wonderful director. And Cynthia and I had to go about figuring out which of these 15 cities were we going to pick to follow these young people launching companies. And there's really exciting things happening all over the country, but nothing like Detroit. So we were just, and when we started the movie, it was, we started filming in July of 2014, so Detroit was still in bankruptcy in a very different city than it is now. So as we tracked our entrepreneurs' personal journeys, we were also tracking the change going on in Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit truly is a character in this film, just as much as all of these hardworking young people.
Absolutely. And people from Detroit who have seen the movie, they come away feeling really happy that we were able to capture the grit, the resilience, the hopefulness, that Detroit hustles harder, the entrepreneurial spirit of that city.
Just kind of give us a sense of who these young people are and some of the businesses that they're trying to build.
Sure. So we have Max Nussenbaum, who came to Detroit in 2012, worked for a startup there for 2 years. He and a few friends bought a house at auction for $8,200. and they were completely clueless about how to renovate a house, but they, you know, dove in and through that experience decided they wanted to launch a company together. So their company is Castle Property Management, so using technology to automate property management. Brian Rudolph had a gluten intolerance and wanted to find a healthy pasta, and he started playing around with chickpea pasta in his kitchen and developed Bonza, the first ever chickpea pasta. So those are the two companies we follow launching. And then Labib, who comes in and works for Mason, which is a company that develops smartphones and tablets, and Dextina Booker, who's working when she arrived for Rock Ventures, and Kate Catlin, who works at Detroit Lab. But they're all, you know, 22 to 24-year-olds, some of them right out of college, really just finding their way as people, first jobs out of college, really clueless in many ways, as we all are when we come out of college, and just diving in and taking risks in a way that most of their generation aren't. Millennials are the kids coming out of college now, the most risk-averse generation in decades.
It's amazing, isn't it, how much they fear failing? I'm a mom. I'm familiar with this. That idea of having to leave that cocoon of college scares
right.
them, and then stepping out into the world. And you really do see these young, all of these young entrepreneurs get their noses bloodied through the course of your film.
I think that's something you definitely, and because we followed some of them for 17 months, it's a real longitudinal study in the trenches with them. I mean, it's a real follow doc. It's not a talking head film. We're with them as they're stumbling and failing. And we also gave them all GoPros. So they filmed themselves in very vulnerable moments, which often, you know, provides a lot of the humor and also, you know, really, really an insider look at that emotional journey of, you know, coming of age and also launching a company, which is a really scary thing to do. And I think even, you know, maybe scarier when you're that young and you really have not had a ton of experience and you're learning every day as you go. But they are all super uncomfortable in these roles they've taken on because they're so in over their heads. And yet they learn to be comfortable in that discomfort. And, you know, more than anything, I think that the film traces their human growth. And they all, at the end, realize that, you know, for them, building companies, moving to Detroit, you know, what they're doing is not, I mean, for none of them, it was ever about money. It really is about doing something bigger than themselves.
We're going to take a listen to a bit of a clip from Generation Startup. And this is about just a wonderful young woman named Dextina Booker, who today works for Shinola. So we know she's still in Detroit. And she came in as a Venture for America fellow working, what, for Rock Ventures?
Yes. She started out working for Rock Ventures, but she went to MIT. She graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering and really, really missed engineering. So now she is working as a mechanical engineer for Shinola Audio and really loving, you know, applying her engineering expertise.
So I'm still trying to figure out, like, if I'm ever going to hit my stride and feel like I'm fully competent at what I'm doing.
Yeah. The nature of what we do is extremely project-based.
Right.
So you'll hit your stride in a certain project, and then a project ends, and you're like, crap, I'm on to the next project, and now I feel again like I don't know what I'm doing. But it's part of the cool pieces about being here, to know that you play a piece in the ecosystem.
That's a clip from Generation Startup, co-directed by my guest, Cheryl Miller Hauser. And Cheryl, you say this film really is not just about entrepreneurship, and you're looking ahead and asking questions really about the future of young companies and future jobs in this country. So how important are these young people to our economic future?
They're hugely important. Entrepreneurship is at a 25-year low. People think we're in this golden age, but we're not. And young companies create two-thirds of all new jobs. So if we don't have new companies being formed, then we're at a standstill in terms of job creation. So it really is critical. Just like entrepreneurship and innovation were the drivers that made Detroit such an amazing city a century ago, it is entrepreneurship and innovation that is driving its renaissance now.
You know, even for those of us who are not of an entrepreneurial mind, you learn so much as you watch what it takes. I mean, I think of Brian Rudolph and Avery Hairston from Bonza, and you look at them and you ask, why do you care so much about making pasta out of chickpeas? And they're asking themselves the same questions, but then we all learn together what that passion is all about.
I think it's two things. It's one, the passion, for sure, and they're all super passionate. And secondly, I think it's slightly the, like, naivete or the blindness, which, you know, or with Max and his friends in with the house, you know, Max says, if we had known what we were getting ourselves into, we would never have done it. But, like, with anything like this, you have to go in a little bit blind. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have the guts to do it.
What do you hope audiences will get out of watching Generation Startup?
I hope that our characters in Generation Startup will inspire people across the country to step outside their comfort zone, to take risks in even small ways. I think that a lot of us, and I know that I have been guilty of this, we're held back by a fear of failing, fear of, you know, making a fool of ourselves. And I think that by seeing these kids, and they do fail, they fail and fail and fail until they figure it out, and then they soar. And that is the only way that we learn and grow. And then the second thing I hope people will take away from the film is what's going on in Detroit. I mean, the people have seen the film so far who are not from Detroit. They come away and they say, oh, my God, I didn't realize what was going on there. Like, what an incredible place. I've got to get myself to Detroit, or I want to move to Detroit. So I'm really excited about this spotlight we're putting on Detroit as well. And the entrepreneurial spirit that we've captured in our kids, but that's really prevalent throughout the city, and the incredible entrepreneurs well beyond our kids who are in Detroit.
Generation Startup will be screened on Sunday, July 31st at 3 p.m. at the Traverse City Film Festival, and it'll also be screened this fall at the Detroit Institute of Arts. You can get all kinds of information by going to GenerationStartupTheFilm.com. Cheryl Miller Hauser is co-director of Generation Startup. I love the film, Cheryl. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, we're opening at the DIA October 7th, so we hope everyone comes out to see the film.
26 years ago this day, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. For the more than 56 million Americans with disabilities, the law has helped to protect them from discrimination. So this is an especially good day to have you meet Cheryl Angelilli. Cheryl broke her neck in a swimming accident when she was 14, and she became a quadriplegic. She then went on to win 4 medals in swimming at the Paralympics, 7 world championships. She set many U.S. and world swimming records. In short, Cheryl is one of Michigan's most decorated athletes with a disability. And now a new challenge and victory. Last night, Cheryl Angelilli and her professional dance partner Tamerlan Gadarov won a medal in the ballroom dancing competition at the Fred Astaire World Championships in Las Vegas. Cheryl is with us now via Skype from Vegas. Welcome, Cheryl, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're very excited.
You and Tamerlan danced to Time of My Life from the film Dirty Dancing, which seems kind of appropriate because I believe I remember your quote is, nobody likes to put me or my wheelchair in the corner.
That's right. The audience usually goes nuts because it's so unexpected. In fact, when I was in the ballroom last night and we finished, guy came up to me, he said, you know, I was sitting there thinking, is he going to do that lift in Dirty Dancing? And he's like, there's no way. And he goes, the next thing I knew, you were up in the air. So it's definitely a crowd-pleasing moment. And actually, I just got a follow request on social media this morning from Jennifer Grey from the movie. So that was really kind of cool.
Very nice. Very nice. What brought you, Cheryl, to ballroom dancing after you decided it was time to retire from winning all those medals in competitive swimming?
You know, I competed in Paralympic swimming for 16 years. And as you can imagine, it consumed a great portion of my life, you know, training and competing to be able to stay at that level of competition. So when I made the difficult decision in 2013 to retire from competitive swimming, it left this huge void in my life. You know, I was looking for something that would give me the same excitement and adrenaline rush that swimming did. And wheelchair ballroom dancing is something I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to do. You know, I danced when I was a little kid, and it's something that an activity that I always enjoy doing. And being a Paralympic athlete, when we were over in Europe, it's very popular over there. So I was exposed to wheelchair ballroom dancing when I would compete in Europe. It's just not popular here in the United States. And every time I would come back and I would inquire with a dance studio, you know, listen, you know, is this something that you would be open to? Is someone who could somebody teach me? You know, I was always met with a lot of apprehension, and just they really didn't know what to do for me or with me for that fact. And then about 2 years ago, on one of my social media fan pages, somebody had posted a post from Fred Astaire Bloomfield Hills that they had hired this teacher from Europe, and he had experience in wheelchair ballroom dancing, and they were kind of just putting it out there. Would anyone be interested in coming in to learn? And of course, I called them right away, and you know, I talked to the owner, and I said, look, I miss dancing more than I miss walking. I would love the opportunity to come in and try this. And it was just an amazing experience. I remember the third lesson that I went in and had with them, because the first two lessons, we were just kind of learning steps and, you know, different things. But the third lesson that I came into the studio, I learned a routine. And from that minute, I fell in love with ballroom dancing, because now I wasn't just learning steps. I was really dancing. So it's just been a real thrill.
And because you are with the Rehabilitation Institute of Michigan, we'll roll the clock forward a little bit. You were able to secure a grant and set up Dance Mobility, the only wheelchair ballroom dancing program in Michigan for children and adults with physical disabilities. So these Dance Mobility classes, what happens and who comes?
Well, that's the great thing is I just knew how much joy and fun I was having with it. And I knew that there were other people that I wanted to share this opportunity with. And wheelchair ballroom dancing is a very expensive sport. So I did apply for a grant from the Rehabilitation Institute of Michigan Foundation. And we started a monthly program, and it's been amazing, the amount of people that come to the program. When I first started the program, I thought we would have all women coming to our class. And it's been really great to see how many men come to our class to learn to dance. And I think it's a lot of it that their wives and their girlfriends are dragging them. But once they're there, they're having a fantastic time. So it's a group lesson, and everybody comes for a different reason. Some people come to learn a new activity or do something with their spouse or their loved one. Other people come just to meet other people with disabilities, or somebody is looking for the exercise and health benefits of dancing. So everybody's reason for coming is different, but once they're there, they're all having a great time.
And these are free of charge.
Free of charge. And recently we started a program for amputees a couple of months ago for amputees who use a prosthetic. And that program is starting to grow. So, you know, it's really a partnership between the Rehabilitation Institute of Michigan Foundation and Fred Astaire Bloomfield Hills, who's really been very open to exposing people to this type of dance that they might not otherwise have been, you know, been able to experience.
What do you love the very most when you're in the middle of doing ballroom dancing with your partner, Tamerlan?
It's just the feeling of being on the dance floor. I mean, I literally feel like I am floating across that floor. It's just an indescribable feeling. Now, you know, if you ask me, is it the same as when I was dancing on my feet? No, but the joy that I feel in my heart when I'm dancing is absolutely the same.
From the moment of that accident when you were 14 to looking back at the journey you've traveled, would you have seen what you've been able to accomplish with your with the swimming medals and the records you've set? Are you surprised that you've been able to do this, or is this just who Cheryl is?
You know, being injured at such a young age, it was really a difficult adjustment. You know, I went from an able-bodied, active teenager to doing all of the things that my friends were doing and coming of an age as a young woman to being a quadriplegic. So it was quite an adjustment. And for, like, you know, the first 3 or 4 years, I mean, I really struggled. So if I could go back and tell my younger, newly injured self anything, it would be that, you know what, you're going to be okay. Life's going to be okay. And, you know, I've just had the fortunate of having great friends and an incredible family who never let me give up and always pushed me to see that there were no limitations. So a lot of that is I'm just blessed to have had a great support system and the determination, too, that I wasn't going to let this stop me. So I think a lot of that all plays into it.
And now through Dance Mobility, these group sessions, you're opening this up to others. And we ought to note the next Dance Mobility group session is August the 27th at the Fred Astaire Dance Studio in Bloomfield Hills. It's a free session, but they'd like you to call ahead and pre-register. So we've put all the details on our website at michiganradio.org. They're on the stateside page. And also, we've got a video of Cheryl and Tamerlan dancing, because it is something to behold. Just beautifully done. And congratulations to you and Tamerlan on winning that medal last night in Las Vegas at the Fred Astaire World Championships. That's great. And I bet you'd love to see more and more people to compete against.
We do. You know, we're here and we're like the only wheelchair couple. We're competing against able-bodied people when we compete at the Fred Astaire World Championships. So we're hoping to grow Dance Mobility at other Fred Astaire studios so that when I come to these competitions, you know, I'm not the only one in the wheelchair. We're fortunate. In October, we're going to go to a competition in Canada. Canada just opened their first wheelchair ballroom dancing competition, national competition. So we'll be going there, and it'll be great to compete against other people in wheelchairs and to network and get to meet some other people and hopefully start a movement here in North America to get more people with disabilities dancing.
Cheryl Angelilli with us via Skype, going from the swimming pool to the ballroom dance floor. So from swim goggles to beautiful makeup and beautiful costumes. Cheryl, congrats and thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Cindy. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They're rolling out the red carpet this Thursday in Flint. It's the Flint Youth Film Festival, a chance for you to see the work of mid-Michigan's young filmmakers. Here with us, Donna Ulrich, who's director of the Flint Youth Film Festival, and filmmaker Alex Douglas, a Flint resident who recently graduated from the Media Arts and Entertainment Technology program at Mott Community College. Donna, is there a theme to the Flint Youth Film Festival?
Well, there was a theme, but we discovered that students, like adults, don't always read. And so our theme kind of got set by the side because young people get really excited about their ideas. And so we said, we'll throw out the theme for the festival and we'll let them do whatever they want. So we've got, you know, murder mysteries and horror and all sorts of things in that theme.
And how many filmmakers submitted entries?
We have 20 films, 16 directors, and about 40 crew members. So about 40 plus young filmmakers involved all the way around.
And when you say young filmmakers, what age are we talking about?
We're starting at age 13, middle school, and we're going up to 25 plus.
From mid-Michigan.
From mid-Michigan, right.
And one of them is Alex. And Alex, you actually submitted two films.
I did.
All right. Tell us about Alex the Dyslexic.
Okay. For Alex the Dyslexic, I was taking a documentary production class at Mott Community College, part of the program. So they wanted us to focus on an issue that a student would be having as they go through a university setting or in community college. I'm dyslexic, and it is difficult for me, and I don't use disability services, and I don't usually tell my professors that I have dyslexia, but it was a good way for me to kind of like speak out to say like what some people might be going through if they didn't really want to like say publicly, this is what I'm dealing with.
So a first-person documentary.
Yes.
Really telling your story. And then Parts Per Billion. Tell us what that story is.
Parts Per Billion is a documentary. Me and my coworker Nick Ferguson, we co-directed on the Flint water crisis because it is a very prominent issue. I live in Flint. All my friends are in Flint. It's something that still needs to be put out in the on the media. And so me and my friend Nick, we went around to all these different activists and asked them their point of view of what was going on with the Flint water crisis, and we put that in our documentary.
And what did you learn? What's the story that you're hoping to tell through this film?
Well, I did this in March, so the story that I was hoping to tell was that it really takes a village to kind of like broadcast what you need to be heard everywhere. And so having all these different voices saying pretty much the same things, all these different walks of life agreeing with each other, was really an important thing for me. And I'm really happy that that came out in Parts Per Billion.
And does it seem that too many of Flint's stories in these recent months have been told or are being told by people who aren't from Flint?
I mean, as long as you can get the news out, that's good. But to have more people telling their own perspective of what's going on with their lives, that would be great, too. So while the loudest voices are the ones that aren't from Flint, it would be nice to have kind of like the smaller ones come up, too, and see like all the different perspectives.
And represented by someone like you who is a Flint resident.
Definitely.
So what's happening down on Thursday night at the event?
So Thursday night is the kickoff of the exhibition for 30 Days at the FIA, but it's also then a celebration of these young people.
And when we say FIA, it's the Flint Institute of Arts.
The Flint Institute of Arts, exactly, which we thank tremendously for everything they're doing for us. So we're going to do the red carpet. We've got paparazzi. We've got an afterglow. We're doing it up Academy Award style, we hope, anyway. But it'll be an opportunity for us to celebrate the various categories. We've got the middle school, high school, and then young adult categories. And then we've got fiction and nonfiction. And so we'll have first, second, and third place prize winners with cash prizes. And so it's, you know, an award ceremony. It's a kickoff for the festival. It's a little bit of everything.
Who did the judging?
We have judges from all over the country, actually. We have colleagues from L.A. who have worked with us, Denver, many professionals in the Flint market as well as the Michigan market. So all professional media makers, filmmakers.
And it is so important for young filmmakers, people like Alex, to start building their resumes and building their careers by getting films screened in a festival, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. And we just got the best compliments from these various judges in their notes. They were all very generous. And we haven't shared those yet with Alex and other other entrants yet, but they just said wonderful things about many of the films. And we also think it's really exciting that these films now have a 30-day exhibition at the FIA for their resume as well.
Why were you drawn to filmmaking, Alex?
It was something about getting the largest audience possible to tell a story, whether it's fictional, non-fictional. You kind of just see a story that you want to tell, a character that you want to portray or something, and you throw them into a story, or you create this narrative that tells their story just how you want to. And there's something really intriguing about that, and having people see the way you think. It's
what are your
unreal.
Goals?
I would like to start working in L.A. In like the fiction film, so Hollywood, that kind of track in the production. But I'll go wherever my life takes me, really.
That's exciting. How does youth filmmaking, Donna, do you think, and storytelling benefit both these young filmmakers and their communities?
There's so many ways. The reason I got involved in it and my colleagues got involved in it is because we recognize that young filmmakers, especially today with the computers, get lost in their computers and let go of the socialization, the networking, the collaborative problem solving. Mm-hmm. The skills development of interacting with others.
That you need to do to make a film.
That you absolutely need. And so that's why we started this program, to help that, because we really believe that as they do something they love and then they work with and get feedback on their scripts, or they get work and get feedback on the technical aspects of the film, that they're developing their skills. And with that development of skills comes confidence. And with that confidence then comes that ability to move on anywhere in the world. But we're hoping, as Alex did with Parts Per Billion, to inspire young people to look at the issues in their own community. And I think all of this leads to the creation of artists who are also very socially conscious and become good citizens in a community. And I certainly want them then helping me make decisions as I mature gracefully.
So we know that the big red carpet event is this Thursday night at the Flint Institute of Arts. But how can people see the films if they couldn't make the Thursday night event?
They can stop in any time during the FIA's normal hours, 8 to 5, I believe the gallery's open. And then they'll also be available at the FlintYouthFilmFestival.com website.
The website is FlintYouthFilmFestival.com. And again, the event is at the Flint Institute of Arts this Thursday night. Donna Ulrich is the festival director. Thank you so much for being with us,
Donna. Thank you.
And filmmaker Alex Douglas, thanks for sharing your vision with us and good luck with your career.
Thank you for having me.
As you watch the political conventions, decide which candidates will get your vote. Here's something you ought to think about and a question to ask. Who helped pay for all that campaigning? And what happens when that newly elected or re-elected member of Congress gets back to Washington? According to the group Issue One, members of Congress spend more than half their time raising money, not governing. In 2010, just 0.26% of the population accounted for over two-thirds of contributions to congressional campaigns. How do we fix America's campaign finance system? Former Congressman Joe Schwartz is with us now. He's a physician, a former member of the state Senate, and these days he's with Issue One's Reformers Caucus. They're battling to reduce the influence of money in politics. Welcome, Congressman.
Thanks very much, Cynthia. Nice to be with you.
The makeup of this Reformers Caucus that you're part of is, to me, remarkable. You have 150 former members of Congress like yourself. You have former governors and both parties who want reform. That's bipartisan cooperation. That's remarkable.
Well, it is remarkable, but when one looks at it under the microscope, maybe not quite as remarkable as one would think, because thinking people, when they go to Congress or when they go to the legislature, it's a little different, but same ballgame. They say, goodness gracious me, what in the world am I got myself into with this absolute pressure, constant pressure, to raise money at times, frequently, when they should be doing something else having to do with policy formulation.
How did it come to this reality that we get members of our Congress spending more time dialing for dollars than actually governing?
There's a lot of pressure on especially junior members of Congress, members who get there for their first and into their second and third terms, to raise money. And they're told by their respective caucuses, in the case the Republicans call themselves a conference, the Democrats call themselves a caucus, told by leadership, you're expected to spend a certain amount of time, and it's really a ridiculously large amount of time, while in Washington, at party headquarters, sometimes actually cold calling people for money. And it's been done that way for years.
Were they doing that when you were on the Hill?
Yes, they were.
And so when you say a ridiculous amount of time, Congressman, what are we talking about, a week?
Well, I would say that members are asked to spend hours every day essentially calling people for money, dialing for dollars. Some do. In fact, most do. Others will push back. That would be myself.
And what happens when you push back and say no?
When I pushed back and said no, I lost a lot of institutional support from the Republican Party, especially the congressional campaign committees, because I just wouldn't do it. And there were a few others like myself who said, I'm just not going to do this, and others who tried to do it and said, well, I'm going to try to be a good soldier and do it, and then backed off and said no. But the pressure to raise money is unbelievable, and I frankly wasn't prepared for it. You know you have to raise money if you're going to run for office at that level, but this seemed to me to be way, way over the top.
And I think most Americans don't really know the workings of the influence of money in politics. And as I was going through the issue1.org website, and I saw the fact that there are $3 billion spent lobbying Congress versus the $2 billion spent running Congress.
I hadn't heard that statistic before, but I wouldn't argue with it. I'm sure it's right. If one looks at what goes on in Washington, it's kind of another world. You go and you're a member of Congress and you see the tremendous amount of pressure for you to raise money, A, and B, do you ask yourself, who in the world, I didn't know there are this many lobbyists in the whole world who wanted to talk to you and influence your vote on various and sundry issues. Now, lobbying is very legal, and I must say this, for lobbyists, they work very hard. What they do is give their clients access to the process, and they work very hard at it. But at some point, it's excessive, and that's one of the things that needs to be addressed.
And what is the Reformers Caucus thinking of in terms of fixing this? What do we do absent waiting for the Supreme Court to act or for the Constitution to be amended?
You've got to limit the time that members of Congress, and we're talking right now about members of Congress, but I could talk about the legislature too. You've got to limit the time, and it's got to be by rule or by statute limited, that you ask members of Congress while they're in Washington, and here's the point, and I want to emphasize this. This is while they are in Washington, not while they're back in their districts. Limit the amount of time that they are asked to or required to, if you view an order from leadership as a requirement, limit the time that they're raising money. There's business to do. There are issues to study and go across the street and cast an intelligent vote, hopefully. And this isn't happening. And I just think it is unbelievable the amount of time the members are asked to raise money in Washington. And the other thing about it is, of course, the citizenry does not know that much about this. They don't know that their congressman or congresswoman is going to Washington and being asked to raise money 2 or 3 hours a day, put in a cubicle with a telephone and say, okay, start calling these people. Here's your list tonight, congressman. Call these people. Ask them to contribute.
And meantime, the citizenry is furious at that perceived overused but accurate term of congressional gridlock, both at a state level and at the national level. Get stuff done.
Congressional gridlock and legislative gridlock, of course, is a reality. What has happened is that the development, shall we say, of where we are now has resulted in members of Congress and members of the legislature having their first loyalty be to the party and not to their country, to their state, not to their constituents, not to the folks at home that they're representing, but to their party. And this wild dash for money is probably the main thing that makes that the case, because the party calls the shots. The party calls the shots as far as your committee memberships in Congress. And it's a given, and believe me, I said, is this true? When I was down there, and then I've talked to other former members and existing members. The amount of money that you raise has a direct effect on your committee assignments. If you're a big-time money raiser and you go to leadership and ask for a certain committee assignment, the probability is that you're going to get it. And so you have people who are not necessarily qualified to sit on certain committees, sitting on those committees, and you ask yourself, why? Well, because they raise more money than the person who was qualified. And that goes for committee chairmanships, too. And people who study Congress understand that that's true.
So top-down change seems extremely unlikely to happen because the poobahs, as you describe, aren't inclined to want to change that, keep raising money. Is there enough oomph from the bottom up to change this, Congressman?
That's a consummation devoutly to be wished, isn't it? That in time, the constituents out in the congressional districts and legislative districts, again, I don't want to leave the legislature out of this.
Right, right.
Will really take notice of what's happening. And enough people like our organization will step forward and say, we got a problem here, folks. And it's not making for good public policy formulation. If that happens, and that will happen over a period of time, certainly not overnight, I think change would be in the air. But right now, it's not. And it was bad before Citizens United, and since Citizens United, of course, it's been insane.
What's at stake here?
What's at stake here is the effectiveness of the U.S. Congress, and again, state legislatures in large states with very active legislatures like Michigan, and the entire way that we govern ourselves and the way it's done is at stake, and the ability of an individual or an organization which has a perfectly good case, or should I say cause, I think maybe cause would be better, to take before the legislature or take before Congress, gets put way down the list because they can't come up with enough dollars, even though they have an issue where God's on their side. They don't have enough dollars. So they're way down the list, and they may not ever get considered, where if you got enough money and you can dump enough money in and get that money where you think you need to get it, you're going to get recognition.
Well, there's plenty for citizens to learn and read by going to the website issue1.org. That's issue1.org. Former Michigan Congressman and former State Senator Joe Schwartz, always great to have you on Stateside. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. Good to be with you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Our engineer today was Rusty Brock. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Daniel Razel, Lindsay Scullin, Cake Summers, and Carl Williams. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.